Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, the 101 northbound in the West Valley is closed at Indian School due to a crash. You want to avoid that area if you can. Again, the 101 northbound in the West Valley closed due to a crash at Indian School. Sunny skies for the rest of the day. Today, look for a high of 96 degrees. It's 95 right now at KJZZ.
Former Arizona Governor Rose Mofford died earlier today at the age of 94. Mofford was best known for two things, her distinctive beehive hairdo, and for helping restore some normalcy to the ninth floor when she took over for the impeached Evan Meekum in 1988. Mofford is being remembered fondly today.
Governor Mofford was Aunt Rose to just about everybody in this state, and if you knew her, that was the way she treated you as a family member.
Former Attorney General Terry Goddard. Goddard called Mofford an extraordinary Secretary of State and that she was the perfect person to pull Arizona back together and get the state on track after Governor Meekum left office.
She established the confidence locally, but that did a world of good to restore our image across the country. So she was Arizona. She symbolized and showed everybody around the country what the best of Arizona. We just seen the worst through the impeachment. And I think what Rose did was to impress people that this was a great place and it had really wonderful people in it.
Goddard says Mofford was a unifier, a sentiment echoed by former State House Majority Whip Chris Hurstum.
She reached across the political aisle. Even though she was a Democrat, she worked very well with Republicans. Rose Mofford was one of a kind, and we'll probably never see another person like her again in our state.
Governor Doug Ducey issued a statement today saying Mofford, quote, both as a governor and a former governor, exemplified the ability of leaders to unite us, to put partisanship aside, and put our country and our state first. During challenging times for our state, Governor Mofford was the steady hand that led us through and held us together.
For more on Governor Rose Mofford and her legacy in Arizona, I'm joined by the Dean of the Capitol Press Corps, Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, Governor Mofford was not new to state government when she became governor. What was her background?
Well, she had a long history in government. She worked in the Arizona Treasurer's Office. She worked at the old Tax Commission. She was a business manager for Arizona Highways. She became Assistant Secretary of State, and she held that position for like 22 years. What happened is that Wes Boland, who was Secretary of State, had succeeded Raul Castro in office when Raul left to become ambassador to Argentina. So Rose became Secretary of State, which is normally the stepping stone to the governor. Well, when Wes Boland died, she could not take his position because she hadn't been elected. So Bruce Babbitt, who was Attorney General, then became governor. Well, she kept her position as Secretary of State, was elected in her own right. Then when Evan Meekum was impeached and convicted by the legislature in 1988, Mofford then became the governor. There was a lot of interesting discussion around it because one of the things that people realized is we were moving from a very conservative Republican to somebody who had been a rural but mostly moderate Democrat. But to Rose's credit, she didn't make any major changes. She certainly did have some viewpoints on how government should be run, but she was a steadying influence after the Meekum years.
Was there anything about her personality, especially as you got to know her both as governor and afterwards, was there anything about her personality that you think maybe made her well-suited to take over at that particular time, which was a fairly tumultuous time in the state?
Well, there were two things working in her favor. Number one was, again, her long history, you know, in state government going back for like 50 years. And so she kind of knew how government ran. The other piece was about her personality. This is a woman who would remember everyone's name. I mean, you could run into her 12 years later and she would remember, oh, hi, how's your wife so-and-so? And what about your kids? And are they going to college yet? And that was very disarming, I think, for people, because you've had a lot of governors who are very standoffish. Rose would go out and shake hands and be everyone's friend. And I think that proved very disarming. And I think that made her more able to work across the aisle with Republicans.
What is your sort of lasting memory of knowing her and working with her?
I think it's that she tried to get along with people. She was always friendly. She certainly tried to do the right thing. I mean, there was a certain learning curve for her, even though she'd been in state government where she needed to understand more about the governor's office. But she tried, and she put a lot of bright people around her, and she understood, as had governors before her like Bruce Babbitt, that the best thing you can do as governor is, since you can't know everything, is hire people who do. So you can go to them and say, how do we do this? And then you as the governor make the policy decision.
That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services remembering former Arizona Governor Rose Mofford, who died earlier today at the age of 94.
Arizona's most famous immigration enforcement law, SB 1070, has been litigated for over 6 years, but that ends today. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block joins us now to talk about a settlement in the works. Jude, the law took effect in 2010, but the legal challenges are just now ending. Can you quickly explain the history here?
Right. So after the Arizona legislature passed SB 1070, the U.S. government brought one legal challenge. That's the one that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And after that ruling, much of SB 1070 was actually gutted, particularly sections that dealt with criminalizing unauthorized immigrants who were in the state. But the Supreme Court did leave a key part standing. That's a section known as Section 2B. It requires local police, when they're enforcing other laws, to check immigration status if they have a reasonable suspicion someone they detain or stop is in the country illegally. So now, at the same time that the federal government was bringing their suit, a coalition of immigrant rights groups had their own separate legal challenge. They were trying different legal arguments to actually strike down the entire SB 1070 law, which has many sections in it, by the way. And in that second case, about a year ago, the judge, Judge Susan Bolton, agreed to strike down an additional part. That one had to do with banning day laborers from soliciting work and from drivers being able to pick them up. And those were actually struck down. But she did allow Section 2B to stay in effect.
And that's the one known as the Show Me Your Papers provision.
Exactly. And that same ruling allowed a second section, 2D, which allows local law enforcement to transport immigrants who are suspected of being here illegally to federal authorities. Judge Bolton allowed both of those sections to stand. And after that ruling, which was mixed, it had victories and losses on both sides, both the state of Arizona and these groups appealed to the Ninth Circuit.
Okay, but rather than have the litigation go forward, now we're hearing there's a settlement in the works. What does that say?
So this is a proposed settlement still because the judge still has to sign off on it. But obviously, you know, the biggest part is getting the two parties, the state of Arizona and these immigrant rights groups, to agree. The gist really is this, that immigrant rights groups will stop challenging Section 2B and Section 2D, the parts about local law enforcement checking immigration status and transporting people to federal agents. And in return, the Arizona Attorney General's office has agreed to issue very clear guidance to law enforcement agencies about how those provisions can and should be enforced. And the immigrant rights advocates clearly feel that the guidance is sufficiently narrow, so they feel comfortable.
All right, let's dig into some of the details here. What exactly does the guidance say?
This is really an attorney general opinion that will be used as guidance, and it makes clear that being in the country illegally is in itself not a crime. It's a civil violation, and local cops can't arrest someone just for being in the country unlawfully. And that's been a point of confusion in Arizona. So the guidance makes explicit that law enforcement can't use race and ethnicity when deciding who they suspect is in the country illegally, and they can't prolong a detention to check immigration status. If they do choose to check immigration status, they can make a call to federal agencies like Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Customs and Border Protection to check on somebody's status, but they have to document those cases, and that data will be collected. If the officer suspects a person they encounter has actually committed a crime, like re-entering the country after deportation, that's an actual federal crime, then there's more leeway under this guidance to actually arrest that individual and bring them to federal authorities, but only if the federal authorities respond quickly.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on a possible settlement on provisions of SB 1070. Jude, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When it comes to economic growth and new jobs over the next few years, the former CEO of Citibank says Arizona and the Southwest are poised to do better than the country as a whole. Eugene McQuaid was the keynote speaker at SRP's annual economic forecast presented by the Phoenix Business Journal. KJZZ's Christina Estes was there and joins me to share what she learned. And Christina, what makes him so bullish on our area?
To put it simply, it's bars and cranes. McQuaid is visiting from New York, and his host showed him around last night. They hit a few bars where McQuaid says they were all full, people standing around. That's a good sign, he says, because people are spending money. And then there are the cranes.
I travel to a lot of cities, particularly my old job, around the world. First thing I look for are cranes in the air. That tells me that something's going on. I saw quite a few of them in my ride in from the airport yesterday.
While the audience at SRP's annual economic forecast included many business owners and corporate executives, there was a piece that will be of special interest to employees. Thanks to a tight labor market, McQuaid told employers they're going to have to pay more if they want to grow their business.
You're going to have to be very mindful of trying to retain the employees that you have now. I think that means particularly your better employees. You need to be focused on making sure they don't get called away.
So, Christina, what kinds of new jobs does he think we'll see here?
Well, he didn't get Arizona specific, but when it comes to the Southwest, McQuaid says we'll see higher growth than the national average in professional and business services, education, health services, hospitality, trade, and transportation.
What about manufacturing?
He says automotive manufacturing is expected to slow as sales peak, but he predicts a bump in commercial aircraft and IT products. Still, that doesn't mean workers here will be making the items. The U.S. has lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, and no one sees them returning tomorrow. But McQuaid says our open spaces and quality of life make Arizona more attractive options than the East and West Coasts.
Well, Christina, we've seen companies move or expand manufacturing operations in Mexico. What did McQuaid have to say about that country's economic outlook?
He expects Mexico's economy to grow at a slightly faster pace than the U.S. To summarize, he said the next couple years should be good, but not great nationally, and better for us in the Southwest. One big disclaimer, though, what he called geopolitics, things could all change depending on a variety of factors beyond our control, from next year's European elections to civil unrest, terror attacks, and wars.
That's KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Traditional taxi services have been hit hard by competition from ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft, and that has led Valley-based Total Transit to evolve its business model. A new app gives riders the chance to choose whether they want to book a taxi, a rideshare vehicle, or a rideshare van. Matt Klassen is Total Transit's general manager. And Matt, why does this make sense when it comes to the way the business is trending?
This is an evolution both from a convenience standpoint. It's easier for the customer to go to their handheld device. Everybody has a cell phone. You can look which vehicle type you need, you can see where you need to go, and you can, more specifically, you can see when that person's coming to pick you up. Whereas with the taxi, primarily you'd have to either call in or maybe text in, or you could even go online and book a trip. You don't know exactly when that person's going to pick you up. Whereas with the app, you have a little bit more visibility of that actual driver accepting your trip, and you can even see from a map perspective, where he is in relation to you.
Is this a situation where we're seeing maybe different generations will use this sort of thing in a different way? So you want to make sure that you keep the folks who may say, yeah, I'd rather just use a normal taxi, but also open up your business to something else.
Absolutely. So we know that more and more people have smart devices. They have that option. However, for that population that maybe A, doesn't have a smart device, or maybe doesn't want a smart device, they can go onto a web booker. They can put in their vehicle type, they can put in their destination and address, and book a ride that way.
Did the company feel like it had to start doing something? Has this been in the works for a while, I guess I'm asking, or there was some legislation in Arizona that created some heartburn for some folks? Is this part of just saying, okay, this is what the business looks like now, so we better start going?
Certainly. Certainly we've seen the industry trend towards TNC, which is a transportation network company, type model, simply because the customers have demanded it. We're seeing the need to evolve ourselves to make sure that we are part of that, you know, the future of transportation as well.
How closely did Total Transit have to follow what was going on even before these other things happened? Just to think, okay, we're seeing trends. Do we want to dip our toe in the water? Do we want to jump full bore? How much planning went into that?
Well, we've done a lot of planning. In fact, a few years ago, we came out with the Total Transit app that kind of had a similar look and feel to this one. You could book a trip through your smart device. You could pick either a taxi or a ride share. And we learned a lot from that. So we took a lot of lessons learned. We listened to our customer and figured out that we need to be able to do that, but at the same time, still offer those customers that don't have a smart device access to this. So we allow passengers to pay with cash. Mm-hmm. We allow passengers to pay with credit card in the car. And we allow those customers that use the app specifically to load their credit card in the app for that added convenience.
I don't want to say this is a long game because things change so rapidly when it comes to this, but it sounds like the company is not thinking super short term either, though. You're trying to plan this out. How big a risk is this from the standpoint that ride sharing, the actual income, at least what I know, initially is not going to be quite as big. So is this part of a transition to sort of see how it goes?
We know that with the ride share, certainly there could be less revenues, but there's also going to be less expenses associated with that. You're not going to have to own as many cars. Similarly, for the driver, they may, at least in idea, they'll think that they're making less, but they have less expenses as well. So the costs are kind of pushed through the driver and then to the passenger as well.
Matt Klassen is the general manager of Total Transit. We've been talking about the company's new rideshare app, Discount Ride. Other big cities have also seen their traditional taxi companies attempt to take on Uber and Lyft at their own game. To tell us about those trends, I'm joined by Andrew Hawkins, who covers transportation for The Verge. Andrew, have other big markets been able to evolve their business to compete in the rideshare game?
New York has the yellow cab, sort of the iconic New York yellow taxi, has really done its best to hold its own. Now, they've lost a lot of market share to Uber and Lyft over the years. While there are around 30,000 drivers for Uber and Lyft, you've also got a pretty substantial number, around 15,000 or so drivers for the yellow taxi system. That ability to hail a cab on the street is still a pretty valuable commodity there, just to be able to walk out to the street, raise your arm, and have a car pull over.
Is there a danger for traditional companies to cannibalize in some sort their own business in the effort to compete with Uber and Lyft?
Uber and, to a lesser extent, Lyft are the two big names in ride-sharing these days. They have, for the last 5 or 6 years, they've really established and taken control of the market in pretty much every major city in the United States, and in Uber's case, around the world. So that has obviously disrupted the traditional taxi cab services in these cities. And you're seeing sort of a variety of different reactions to the disruption that Uber and Lyft present. At first, it was there was a sense of denial that there was not going to really be that much of a competition. But then as Uber and Lyft both really started to take off amongst customers, I think it was a realization amongst traditional taxi services that they needed to do something. They needed to get on this technology bandwagon and really give it the best shot that they could.
Is this, I don't want to say too little too late, but is there a risk of that?
There really is. I think you make a good point that it's been a while, and these tech companies, these sort of upstart startups have come in and they've really already established themselves as major players. Maybe a few years back there would have been a better chance, but now most people have heard of Uber. Most people have heard of Lyft. They prefer one or the other. They've come in. They've established themselves. They've both raised billions of dollars in venture capital. They've struck partnerships with a lot of major brands, car companies. Lyft made a huge partnership with General Motors at the beginning of the year, that is really going to sort of set the stage for a completely driverless, autonomous system of taxi services in the future. And Uber obviously just rolled out their own self-driving car service in a very limited format in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania this week. So they're already looking to the future. And I feel like these companies have felt that they've come in, they've really kind of upset the apple cart in a lot of ways. And now they're looking to the next level, this driverless future that a lot of technology folks and academics and engineers are predicting is going to be a major component of our transportation network in the future. So whether or not the traditional cab companies can really keep up with that is a really big question.
Andrew Hawkins is a transportation reporter for The Verge. Is Phoenix the next Silicon Valley? It's a question that's being asked a lot lately, as more Bay Area startups are putting down roots in the Valley of the Sun, where rents are cheap and wages are too. But with a sometimes divisive national reputation and some controversial policies, will the state's socially conservative politics stop us from becoming the entrepreneurial mecca we could be? That's the question the show's Lauren Gilger brought to a few leaders in the tech world here. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
And so, Lauren, this is the point that's been raised in many of these articles, places like the New York Times, about Silicon Valley companies that are moving here. Is there any truth to it?
So that depends on who you talk to. First, I talked to Steve Zylstra. He's the president of the Arizona Tech Council, the trade association here. And he told me they've done some studies and surveys on this, actually, and there's a difference between how this affects individual employees and entire companies.
Our member companies are not having a hard time attracting talent here. This is a terrific place to live and to work. It's a relatively low-cost quality of life standard of living, and we're able to own homes, and you're not able to do that in places anymore like Boston and Silicon Valley. Now, economic developers will tell you that when they're trying to attract an entire company, these kinds of political positions can really inhibit their ability to do that.
So he thinks companies care about politics.
Well, he says they care about policies and how those policies can affect their company.
I do think that policies like Senate Bill 1070, later on Senate Bill 1062, which dealt with religious freedom, can have a negative impact on the impression people have of Arizona across the U.S. and globally, and that's a detriment to the folks that are working hard to attract people, the workforce, and company here to Arizona.
But overall, Zylstra really thinks that the stars are aligning for tech companies here in the Valley. He says we have a really pro-business governor, we have a corporate tax situation that's great for business, and when I asked him if we are on our way to becoming the next big hub for entrepreneurship in the country, here's what he said.
I do. I equate it to sort of a tipping point, and I think the fact that Apple made such a strategic move here, taking over that sapphire glass factory and turning it into a global command center for all of its data centers around the world. It's making a $2 billion investment. I believe that that is an indication for me that we've made it. And I think that the current governor also gets this new economy, if you will. You may have noticed that he's been a strong supporter of Airbnb and Uber and Lyft, and I'm sure that sends a positive message to people who are looking to move here to Arizona.
So is it all about Arizona being business-friendly politically?
Not necessarily. I also talked to Hamid Chojaei. He's the founder of Axosoft, a software company here in the Valley, and he's also been really involved in building up the startup community here for a long time, and he thinks there's a lot of excitement driving the industry now. He says if you compare Silicon Valley to Arizona, there are so many benefits to life here in Arizona that it's definitely the place for him. But when I asked him if Arizona has an image problem, here's what he said.
It's true. So, and it's mostly like the stuff that we make it to the news for. Arizona is an awesome place, but when the national debate is that Arizona wants to kick out immigrants or stop them without any reason and prove that they're legal residents, those type of conversations are not helpful. So the ways in which that can hinder us is that if a Silicon Valley-based company finds a company in Arizona interesting and wants to potentially purchase it, they might think twice about having a location in Arizona.
So do you get reactions from people like in Silicon Valley when you go every month or so to do networking stuff? Do people say, what are you doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I get that all the time. And that's really frustrating because I'm like, Arizona is the best place to be, you know?
So do you think growing this industry here, though, and like the progress that you've made as an entrepreneur and as a community of entrepreneurs here is countering that, though, is fighting that image?
Yeah, because first of all, as a tech company, especially as a software company, when you build a software product, your product can immediately be sold internationally, right? So one of my first customers for Axosoft, when I started charging for that product, was from Germany. Like, my first order came from Germany. So immediately you're building this sort of international company when you're in tech in a lot of senses. And it makes you have a different perspective on things. It makes you embrace differences. And I think that the more we have success with tech companies flourishing in Arizona, the more people that would have to embrace that diversity and move us in the right direction.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Valley entrepreneur Hamid Shojaei about the rising tech industry in Arizona. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I am Arizona Rick, the magical bloom-making cowboy.
What color do you want the unicorn's hair?
Whoa, look out. I hate when that happens. They put a hole in both ends, it doesn't work. When I stop at a table to make a balloon, I'm loud, I'm rowdy. This is a theater. This is my theater. You want the Ooga Booga spider? It's a spider that goes Ooga Booga, Ooga Booga, Ooga Booga. All right, I have to measure your brain. Just using the simplest medium of you know, balloons, you make connections with everybody.
That's Rick Fout making balloon animals at Jalapeno Inferno in North Scottsdale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to give us a twist, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
In a check of international news on KJZZ, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is again the source of controversy. A witness in a Senate inquiry on extrajudicial killings claims to have seen Duterte, while he was mayor of a city named Davao, kill a Justice Department agent with an Uzi. A government minister called the allegations, quote, lies and fabrications.
Duterte has the nickname of the Punisher for his tough stance on drug dealers and users. In the past month, the number of people said to have been killed have jumped to nearly 3,000. But where do those numbers come from and can they be believed? The BBC's Jordan Dunbar and Charlotte McDonald investigate.
During President Duterte's election campaign, he promised to unleash the police to battle criminals. Mr. Duterte promised to kill 100,000 in his first 6 months in office and dump so many bodies in Manila Bay that the fish will grow fat. He told police officers that if they killed people during their duties, he would protect them.
His tough stance seems popular. He won the election.
President Duterte says he wants to tackle crime linked to the highly addictive drug shabu, which is a type of crystal meth. He's declared a crackdown on drug dealers and addicts, and he actually said at a press conference, if you know of any addicts, go ahead and kill them yourself.
We've spoken to Phelim Kine, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch in Asia, to ask what's going on and what's known about the people who are getting killed.
The government is circulating lists at the local, what they call the barangay level, of suspected drug users and drug dealers. And people who are on these lists are turning themselves into local authorities in efforts to try to clear their names or to find out how and why they got on these lists in the first place. And what we're seeing in multiple instances is that people who end up on these lists go to the local police station to try to clear their names, get their details taken down by the police, and then a few days later, unidentified masked gunmen roll up on a motorcycle and kill these people.
But it's not just the people on the list. More people are turning up dead.
There are far greater number of those dead people who aren't on those lists. And what you find is that they end up on street corners, you know, crudely wrapped up in packing tape with stab wounds and bullet wounds, and with a crudely lettered cardboard sign next to their body saying, I am a pusher, learn from me. They didn't necessarily end up on a list, but they got, you know, targeted by someone who decided that they are or could be a criminal element that needed to be killed.
The BBC recently did a report into the hired killers who've seen an increase in contract killings since the crackdown began. As we've heard already, there are estimates that the death toll during this period has reached around 3,000 since Duterte took office.
And these figures are actually coming from the police. They're providing journalists with the numbers of people that officers have killed, which is not even half of the total. The police are attributing the rest of the deaths to unknown killers.
But can we trust the police figures?
That's why I got in touch with one of the national newspapers in the Philippines that publishes a daily list of the number of people who have been killed in the crackdown.
Hello.
Is that BJ?
Yeah, Jordan, yeah.
Thanks very much for speaking to me. Are you happy?
I called up BJ Bergoglio, a researcher at the Daily Inquirer, and asked him, how does the newspaper collect its figures? Now, the phone line wasn't that great, but what he told me is that they're from daily information they get from the police, plus where their own reporters get to a murder scene. But even with all these bits of information, their total is only about two-thirds of the official totals from the police. BJ says the police have better information, but their total is still an underestimate, as there are probably lots of killings that aren't being reported.
The BBC's Jordan Dunbar and Charlotte MacDonald.
The Arizona State Board for Charter Schools has approved an intent to revoke the charter of a Mesa school that closed just as school was supposed to start. And recently, charter schools caught the eye of John Oliver on his HBO show Last Week Tonight.
In Philadelphia alone, at least 10 executives or top administrators have pled guilty in the last decade to charges like fraud, misusing funds, and obstruction of justice, which may be why Philly Magazine advises parents, don't forget to Google any schools you're looking at to make sure they weren't once unexpectedly shut down or run by a CEO who pleaded guilty to theft.
In response to the monologue, the Center for Education Reform launched what it's calling the Hey John Oliver, Back Off My Charter School video contest, which aims to show how charter schools help students and their families. Joining me now to break down this back and forth is Diane Schanzenbach, the director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. It's a nonpartisan economic think tank that looks at a variety of policies, including education. And Diane, so we have John Oliver ripping into charters, charters respond with a video contest. Do you think overall charter schools suffer from a perception problem?
You know, I was surprised by John Oliver's monologue there. You know, I always think he's very funny, but I would say that he could have made a lot of the same points about the Chicago Public Schools, where our most recent CEO is going to jail for accepting bribes. So, you know, I think that the broader issue that he raised, which is there's bad stuff that's going on in the field is worthwhile, but I don't think that there's any evidence that charter schools are worse on this.
As far as the management of schools, be they public or charter, would you say that there is roughly the same amount of good and bad between those two groups?
Yeah, I don't know that we have solid evidence on that, but I also don't think we have solid evidence that charter schools are worse, you know, on these. We, you know, the evidence shows that there's a lot of really good charter schools out there. There's a lot of mediocre ones and some that seem like they're not doing a good job at all. And it's devilishly complicated actually to sort out which ones are which, because the issue is that a lot of times charter schools locate in places where they serve the most highly disadvantaged students. So then if you look to see, you know, what are their test scores like, you would not expect that, you know, that they would be scoring off the charts or even, you know, in the middle of the distribution, because, you know, they're serving kids who are worse off than the average student. And it's often very hard to disentangle the impacts of who goes to charter schools in the first place and what's their impact.
Do you find that perceptions of charter schools, and maybe as we talked about the good and the bad in both charter schools and district schools, is that evenly distributed geographically? Are there some places where people perceive charter schools differently, better or worse than others, and maybe some parts of the country where charter schools actually seem to be doing better or worse than others?
Sure. You know, I think there's a wide variation across the entire country. So I wouldn't even say, clear that in the Northeast they do one thing, in the Midwest they do something else. But the variation seems to be mostly in urban areas versus everywhere else. And there are these pockets of real excellence in, you know, some urban charter schools, like in New York City, in Boston, and so on. And now, of course, there's this example that, you know, New Orleans has gone to an entirely charter district, and I think people are still trying to sort out what's been the impact of that. But then Arizona has always been an outlier in terms of charter schools. Ever since they started collecting data on this, Arizona's always led the nation in terms of the highest share of students enrolled in charter schools, and then also the highest share of students with access to charter schools, which we measure as having a charter school in your zip code. So the most recent data are that about 18% of Arizona school children attend charter schools, which is by far the highest level across any of the states. And then you would say about 85% of Arizona students have access. That is, that there's a charter school nearby them that they could, in theory, attend.
Do you think that we are going to continue to see more and more charters open up? I mean, do you think we sort of hit the ceiling of how many charter schools we'll have in this country? Or do you think we're going to keep seeing more open up?
You know, across the country, I think we will still see more and more charter schools open up. Arizona, on the other hand, it's already, like I said, it's the leader. You know, we've seen large and steady increases in charter schools in Arizona over the last 15 years. You know, I think a question is how much further can Arizona go? And I'm not sure that we have a good answer for that. I would be surprised, you know, if we saw the enrollment share in charter schools go much higher than this. But of course, you know, I guess you can never really predict. So I think there will be growth, but I think that it's unlikely that a lot of that growth is going to be driven by Arizona moving forward.
Diane Schanzenbach is director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. Diane, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Today is the annual kickoff for the Arizona SciTech Festival. The events themselves will be after the new year. Joining me to talk about it is Jeremy Babinder. He's the festival's executive director. And Jeremy, what's new that you're planning for this year?
So this event launches the beginning of the planning stages for the festival itself, which happens in February and March. And so we do this annual kickoff, which happens in September, to really pull this grassroots network that puts on the events. And so it's a great way where people that are passionate about STEM and education to get together and really share their best practices and philosophies about STEM and education.
This is a field that I would imagine is evolving fairly quickly. How much do you try to stay on top of that when you're planning what to do in this festival?
The part I find fun is that we have a lot of really engaged collaborators that are very proactive to tell us what they think should be covered. And so this year, there was a real surge of interest with computer science. And so, for example, we have a whole track on coding and computer science and hackathons, which we hadn't had before. But also we thought it would be fun to integrate this idea of future STEM pathways. And so talk about things like personalized medicine or UAVs or robotics and drones, just the idea to really have the audience understand where we're going.
What role do you think that this festival plays in general in getting students interested in STEM and possibly prepared for careers in STEM fields? Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the time we talk in our realms about what's happening in the schools for traditional education. The important thing is also to complement that with what we call informal education. So how do we get the community to start engaging and really complementing what we see in the schools, giving adults a proactive role to really show that our community is part of STEM? And so the great thing about it is you can engage cities and government entities, community members, to really be part of that solution. And the festival is really more of that convening point to make that happen. And so as an organization, we help to pull it together, work with them, and really think about proactive ways to not just get the students engaged, but the entire community to make it part of who we are in our DNA.
Is that challenging to find enough people who are knowledgeable enough about some of these emerging and new fields to really talk to communities, talk to cities, talk to students, talk to parents, talk to all these groups that need to be engaged in this?
I actually find it is actually not as hard as long as the communities are enthusiastic. The part which I think there's different levels. You could say, you know, for example, my background's biotech. So maybe I'm a STEM professional in biotechnology, but somebody that's an auto mechanic or, you know, a nurse, there's a lot of professions where people have a very solid STEM background, but may not often associate that they know this. And so a lot of it is really helping them realize, okay, they actually have these future STEM-based careers, but to get them to be more meaningful and knowledgeable that they can talk about that to the community.
Given the state of budgets for school districts, does that make events like the SciTech Festival more important? Because I would imagine some of these things that you'd like to try to do in schools are fairly expensive.
What we find is that if the school district is strategic about it, it actually doesn't cost that much more money. A lot of it might be sweat equity, you know, resources and time to really put the event on. But often they may be doing a science night or they may be doing a science expo. Some of the places we may say, hey, are you going to do a science night? Why not consider moving it to your local community center where they have a science festival event? And then you can help leverage kind of market mass. And so they may get a lot of people that don't know about their school to come attend their event. Because often if a school does an event, you're preaching to the choir in a way. You're getting a lot of parents. possibly not the people that are in your community that may be questioning what the resources are used for.
Do you think that Arizona schools are doing a good enough job of preparing students for STEM careers?
I most of the teachers that I meet really are passionate about what they do and excited. I think a lot of the times they may not have the resources that they want or the knowledge. And so a lot of this is hopefully to provide an added level of resources or ability for them to really choose where they want to go and hopefully connect the dots.
Jeremy Babender is Executive Director of the Arizona SciTech Festival. Jeremy, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Most of us who use the internet know what's on the surface as we use various search engines to find information and communicate with other people. But there are levels and layers far beyond the everyday activity, known as DeepNet or DarkNet. ASU Associate Professor Paulo Shakarian and his lab have developed what they're calling a machine learning system to help find out what's going on in the deep, especially if they're possible starting points for cyber attacks. Paulo, why is it important for us to know more about what's going on in areas that Google, for example, just can't reach?
Because these sites are more difficult to get to, and for the sites in the dark web, they allow a rather high level of anonymity. Individuals such as criminals, malicious hackers, they can operate with relative impunity in these sites, and this enables economies of black market activity to flourish.
Is it a safe assumption to presume that if you're in the dark web, you're there for a reason and you're trying to do something underhanded?
Not necessarily. The dark web, especially Tor, was originally invented for some rather important reasons. So, for instance, there are many countries around the world that I'm sure we can name a few, that have significant censorship restrictions, and the dark web enables people like dissidents to communicate better with the outside. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a dual-use technology where there are good purposes. In my research, we've been focused on the use of this technology to proliferate malicious software and exploits used in cyber attacks.
Is there a weekly total you could give me of things that really look questionable? And how does your machine learning system not only find them, but is it capable of disarming them?
What we do deals less with disarming them as opposed to identifying what this market activity is like. So let me give you a for instance. In early 2015, Microsoft identified a flaw in the Windows operating system. And in that same year, there were about 15,000 software flaws that were identified. Cyber defenders have to prioritize which flaws they fix, and some of them actually never get fixed. If you know what the malicious hackers are trying to, which flaws they're trying to turn into weapons, this can help you make better decisions as to what to fix and sort through this large volume of vulnerabilities. So we identified a product for sale for this particular Windows vulnerability in April of 2015. And it wasn't until July of the same year that this particular exploit was first seen in the wild. So by using this kind of information, is you can make better decisions to protect against certain types of emerging cyber threats. And this is very important for big companies.
How much can the work you're doing put a dent and continue to put a bigger dent in some of the security issues?
The pace at which hackers operate is frantic. And there is this notion in cybersecurity today that cybersecurity is what's called offense-dominated, which means that the defenders have to protect all doors to their system, and the attacker just has to find one door that's unlocked. By understanding what the attackers are currently working on, we can better focus our resources to defend against what's coming in the future.
Paulo, does your system at this point have things in place to make sure that if someone is, you mentioned the dissident situation before, if someone is in the deep web for a reason other than a criminal act, can they somehow maintain their privacy with the work you're doing?
Yeah, so to be clear, we're not trying to de-anonymize or find any particular identities. Rather, we're more focused on what the hackers are up to and what they're buying and selling and cataloging this kind of information. And our technology is specifically designed around cybersecurity and identifying things within this community. what we found early on is that there's a lot of crime and other activities on deep web and dark web. And we made a choice early on to focus on cyber and design machine learning algorithms that would allow us to better understand this aspect of it, which alone is quite huge.
Are you even surprised? Are you even daunted by some of what you're finding?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting to see is so we got a team of about a dozen linguists who support this effort at ASU. And what's been really interesting to see is that malicious hacking communities in parts of the world that you might not normally think about, such as Vietnam and Brazil and Japan, they're growing. And I think that as we see more of the world come online, we're going to see more of these malicious hacking communities in different countries all over the place. I think we're, to many extent, unfortunately, at the beginning of a very big trend of black markets for cyber weaponry.
That's Paulo Shakarian, associate professor at ASU. We've been talking about his team's efforts to stop cybercrime in the deep net.
For decades, Cubans have come to the United States to start a new life. Although they've established new roots here, many still feel invested in what happens in their home country. It'll take time for Cold War tensions to thaw between the U.S. and Cuba, but the show's Annika Klein tells us support from Cuban Americans could speed up that process.
Once again, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is flight 387, now departing to Santa Clara, Cuba.
Last month, a quick flight from Fort Lauderdale to Santa Clara broke a half-century hiatus of commercial flight from the U.S. to Cuba. The rest of the routes roll out between now and December.
All the major airlines are flying to Cuba. Spirit got some routes, Frontier, Alaska, even some smaller players like Silver Airways.
Jeff Klee is CEO of CheapAir.com. He says there's been a huge pent-up demand from Cuban Americans for commercial flights, and soon it'll be a lot easier for them to travel back and forth. But Manuel Cias doesn't think he'll get on one of those planes anytime soon.
Para mí, en este caso, nada ha cambiado.
For me in this case, nothing has changed.
Cias came to Phoenix from Cuba 11 years ago with his wife and infant son. They were refugees, and he says the organization that resettled them gave them two options because Miami was too full.
They gave us like cold place and this hot place here. And we prefer the hot because we are from Cuba. I don't like the snow.
Now they run a restaurant and bakery.
It's not Miami food, it's Cuban food.
Cias says he could visit Cuba, but he's not jumping on the bandwagon right now because he doesn't think the Cuban government is really open to change.
It's a country that's been dominated by communism for 50 years, and I don't think they're going to give up their power and their authority.
And that's an opinion shared by many other Cuban Americans, even after the restoration of diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Cuba. A poll released by Florida International University Wednesday shows 41% of Cuban Americans in Miami believe that major political changes in Cuba will never occur.
And it's always a very pessimistic environment that we encounter.
Guillermo Grenier is one of the pollsters at FIU's Cuban Research Institute. They've been doing the same survey for 25 years. He says despite that lingering pessimism, there's a rising trend among Cuban Americans who support increased relations between the U.S. and Cuba.
There seems to be a widening recognition that normalization, if you want to call it that, or at least engagement, is what's going to be happening in the future.
A majority of Cuban Americans in Miami support expanding business relations between the countries. 74% support unrestricted travel by all Americans to Cuba. And 63% want to end the embargo. Grenier says that's the highest they've ever seen. Manuel Cias belongs to those majority opinions, too. He says he wants others to discover Cuba and connect with it.
I would recommend that anybody who wants to go should go. In this moment, it's a very safe place. The government takes good care of the visitors because they are a good source of money. Maybe better than they take care of their own people who live there.
Grenier says the newer Cubans are to the U.S., the more positively they respond to increased travel and other engagement policies. And he thinks those opinions will make waves on the island, too, with the increased contact and connections.
The direction, the trend you'll see, I mean, you can bet on this, that if the Cuban government is going to survive, it will change, perhaps in measured steps, but the desire for change is now very real among the Cuban people.
It's clear Manuel Cias has held on to his personal connections to Cuba. He hand-makes the Cuban pastries and sandwiches in his restaurant every day, but he points out if he'd stayed, he probably wouldn't have the means to open his own business.
Thanks to this country, because I have my house, I have some, my cars, my business, so this is America.
And he's happy to be here. But with enough change, he says, one day he hopes to take his son to Cuba to show him where their journey began. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
And you can find a link to the full poll results from Florida International University on our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.